I'm grateful to Janet Grosser and family who have sponsored the shiur in loving memory of Janet's mother, Rachel Perel Bas Moshe, on the occasion of her first yahrzeit. I remember being Menachem Ava last year and hearing so much about your mother, who I did not know, but heard so much about her, and then going to the simcha right after that. That was quite memorable, as well as by the Sokol family, and we thank Susan Sokol for their sponsorship in loving memory of Susan's mother, Bracha Bas Yeshayahu, whose yahrzeit is this coming week on Yud Kislev. So we hope that our Divrei Torah will be in Ilui HaNeshama for them, and that it will be a meaningful day and commemoration for your families. So many of the stories that we read in Parshas Bereishis and Sefer Bereishis are riveting. Many of them are so enthralling, but also I find that they're extremely difficult to understand and fully appreciate. It's so clear as you read through the stories that so many of the major details of these stories are missing, and the actual psukim don't describe the entirety of the episode, the entirety of the experience, and we're left to the fascinating interpretations of Chazal, of the various midrashim, of the Gemara itself, the Tanaim and the Amoraim. So as I was going through this week's Parsha, one story which caught my attention was the story of Yaakov and Rachel and their struggle with infertility. And infertility is something that is very much on my mind, as I often meet and speak with local couples who encounter both primary and secondary infertility. It's an extremely challenging parsha. It's exceedingly painful for those who go through it, and it's a highly expensive journey, which is just as an aside, that unless one is personally involved in it, and I have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I never have been personally involved, but involved on a personal level with many others who have, it's very hard to relate to the severity of the issues, of the possible treatments, of the understandings, of how completely overwhelming it is to deal with this challenge, to deal with this very, very difficult nisayon. Actually, myself and Rabbi Leibowitz have decided to join this year the upcoming A-Time Shasathon, which is, I've been told, a very uplifting and meaningful day where they have 300 sets of chavrusas who learn together all of Shas under one roof in one day, and it's supposed to be as a schus, as a merit, I guess also as a fundraiser for all of those who are painfully struggling with infertility. And together we felt that this would be a way. It's very hard to give support when we don't have the money to give support and when we don't have always the words to say, but we thought it was a very strong sign of support to go together and to learn and to show them how much we care and how much it means to us, the struggle that they're going through. So with that in mind, I thought that this week would be an opportunity for us to take off from our regular Pirkei Avos series that we have, the regular schedule, and perhaps discuss one of the puzzling stories that we find in this week's Parsha that really focuses on this sugya, on this very difficult Parsha of infertility. So let's just begin with the psukim themselves. Parshas Vayetze, we have a lot of very complicated stories. Yaakov Avinu, as we know, runs away. He's a fugitive. He's afraid of his brother. And he has no option other than to run away from his parents' home. And as we all know the story, he ends up going to a certain community. He stands there by the well, and lots of great things happen. And then, Vayev Yaakov es Rachel. And Yaakov lays his eyes on Rachel Imenu, and he very much appreciates her. Vayomer, and he says to Lavan, Evadcha sheva shanim berachel bitcha katana. I will work for you for 7 years, which is a very long time. He's going to work for 7 years in order that he should be worthy of getting this very special wife by the name of Rachel. Vayavod Yaakov berachel sheva shanim. He works as planned, as promised. He works for 7 years. Vayu beinav ki yamim achadim be'ava so oso. Now this is already complicated because when you have somebody who's excitedly looking forward to their wedding day, to an anniversary, to a vacation. So they don't say, I'm so excited that the days seem to be passing so quickly I don't even notice that that time is passing me by. It goes in the opposite direction. When I'm very much anticipating something, it feels like every day is an eternity. I can't wait until I get to that exciting moment in my life, until I get to that momentous occasion. And here, the Torah says that Yaakov Avinu felt such a tremendous passion and such a love and appreciation for Rachel Imenu that he didn't even notice that it was 7 years that he was working. He didn't even pay attention to it. So that needs some kind of interpretation. But then the Torah says, also, every pasuk here is hard to understand. And you need to really take a lot of time to figure out everything. Vayar Hashem ki sinu aleya. In the end, as we know, He ends up with Rachel, he ends up with Leah, and he was tricked, and he had all kinds of problems as a result. Vayar Hashem ki sinua Leah. It seems, on face value, that Leah was not as beloved as Rachel, which makes sense. It makes sense. Obviously, the plan was he's going to work for 7 years, he's going to end up with his wife, Rachel, and he comes to the wedding, and it's somebody else. So, that's something that can be very resentful. It's not who I planned, it's not what the plan was, it's not what we made up, it's not what we agreed upon. So, Vayar Hashem ki sinua Leah. God saw that Leah was the underdog, that Leah was the one who was a little bit rejected by Yiftach as Rachma, and as a result of that, he blessed her with children immediately. V'Rachel Akara, and Rachel was barren. Rachel was infertile. In fact, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yevamos that all of the Avos and Imos is not just that they struggled with infertility, it's that they were Akurim, which means they had, the women had no uterus, the men had no ability to have children. It was completely unnatural for them to have children at all. That's what the Torah says, that's what the Gemara understands, was the story of the Avos and the Imos. And why is it so? My father often points out, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu set it up that way? It's not like they had a certain problem, they went to a doctor, they took a medication, and then it worked out. Why was it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it that naturally they were unable to have children without some kind of divine intervention, without some kind of miracle? My father often points out because it was to remind us that for the entire history, for the entire trajectory of the Jewish people, we are always going to be living l'mala min ha-teva. There is nothing about the history of the Jewish people that makes sense. Starting from the inception of the Jewish people, it doesn't make sense. You have a woman who has no uterus, she can't have a child, it's impossible. So today we have a uterine transplant, it's an amazing breakthrough in science, and it works, and it's a very high retention rate, and it's really an amazing area of study to think about. But at the same time, under natural course of events, that kind of woman is unable to have a child. A man who is infertile cannot have a child, it's just impossible. And yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching the Jewish people that this is going to be your story for all eternity. It will always be l'mala min ha-teva. So much about the existence of the Jewish people as a whole really does not make sense. So the Torah says, Vatera Rachel ki lo yalda li'Yaakov. So Rachel is noticing as her sister Leah is having one child after the other, and she is left out, and she is not having any children. This needs an interpretation. Vatikane Rachel ba'achosa. Rachel is resentful. Rachel is jealous. Rachel is envious of her sister. Vatomer al Yaakov, and she says, Habali banim. Also needs an interpretation. She says to Yaakov, give me children. What do you think? It's Yaakov's ability to give children? Yaakov was the husband. He's not God. And that is his response. Vim ayin, and then she says very dramatically, she gives a whole emotional speech. Vim ayin mesa anochi. If I don't have a child, it's as if I'm dead. Why am I here? What's the point? Vayicharach Yaakov b'Rachel. Yaakov is very upset. Vayomer, and he says, Hasachas Elokim ani. Do you think that I am a substitute? Do you think I am the replacement for God? Asher mana mimech pri abaten. God is the one who decided you shouldn't have children. You're coming and crying to me. You're saying I should give you children. It's not in my hands. Vatomer, and she says, Hine amasi bilha. Okay, if I'm not going to have children, maybe try with somebody else. Try with my maidservants. And maybe something will come from that. That is the crux of the story. A lot to unpack here. Very, very troubling story on so many levels, as we pointed out. About 20 years ago in Eretz Yisrael, there was a case that came to the Beis Din HaGadol of Yerushalayim. And they have recorded many, many of the cases. It's called Piskei Dinim Rabbaniim, where they just write up what the story was, what the case was, how they paskin. It's pages and pages long. These are like articles and articles, just forever long. It's hard to find anything that's relevant for what you're looking for. But here I came across a story that actually brings to light a little bit of this story here. Rachel Imenu, we're told, on the simple level, Vatikane Rachel Ba'achosa. She was resentful. She was envious. She was jealous of her sister. So it's very interesting. There was a case here. It says it's from Tavshin Samach Bey, so that's 20 years ago. Ki habal chayv legarish ishto. There was a Beis Din, not in Yerushalayim, there was a Beis Din that gave a psak that a husband needs to give his wife a get. What was the psak based on? Psak was that the story that they describe here is that not only does he have to give his wife a get, but she, upon receiving the get, does not get any of her ksuba money that is normally entitled to a woman who gets divorced. So how can that be? How can it be that a husband has to give his wife a get and he doesn't have to pay the ksuba? That doesn't make sense. So the Gemara gives a number of examples when a couple gets divorced, but the husband does not have to pay the ksuba. The Gemara says, if it's very clear if it's undeniable that the woman is at fault for destroying the marriage, for example, the woman had an affair and now they can't continue to live together, so she's clearly at fault for destroying that marriage, she doesn't deserve a ksuba. They have to get divorced, but she doesn't get a ksuba. So it's unusual, but that's the set of circumstances where we would say that a woman is not entitled to a ksuba. 90% of the time, a woman of course gets the ksuba and a lot more. But over here in these kinds of unusual situations, she would not. So what was the story here? The story was that they told this man that he has to give his wife a get, but that she's not entitled to the money of the ksuba. And she came later to try to argue that psak was an error and it was unfair to her, and she wanted the Bezdin HaGadol of Yerushalayim to overturn the psak of the smaller Bezdin wherever they were. So the story was, what happened was, this was a couple who lived in Tayman, in Yemen, and there, they I guess still believe in polygamy, and that was legal at the time, and this man had married two wives. How he kept up with two wives, I'm not exactly sure. I always wonder, how does polygamy work? You know, forgetting about legal or illegal, it just amazes me. Just the pairs of shoes. Like, how many closets does he have for all of these women that he has in his life? I'm not sure. Anyway, so this man married two women. That was not a negative comment. It's wonderful. So then it says that they moved out of Tayman. They moved to England. After they moved to England, they moved to Israel. So he is picking the family up and moving all over the place. After they got to Israel, he decided that whatever it was, one of his wives was somebody who he was no longer attracted to, not physically, but something about her was very bothersome to him. And he was living in one city with one of his wives, and his other wife was living somewhere else. So the Bezdin said, that's unreasonable. How can you hold this woman captive? You're not even living in the same city as her. You're not taking care of anything. How can you not give her a get? So the Bezdin forced him to give a get to his wife. Fine. Now, what rationale was there for him not to pay the ksuba? So the first Bezdin said, well, her claim was that she was not beloved because there was another woman involved in this marriage. And that's why she felt very rejected. And because of that, she resented him, he resented her. And his claim was, that's what you signed up to. You know, we lived in Yemen, and at the time when we got married, everybody in our community was marrying two wives. That was standard. So this is what you signed up to. So what are you getting upset down the line when you don't feel that you're getting the attention that you deserve? Look at the next paragraph where they overturned, they revisited the whole case and they overturned the psak and they said that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous to say that a woman doesn't deserve a ksuba because she feels uncomfortable with her co-wife. She feels uncomfortable with this woman that's taking all the attention of her husband. So look at this. I just thought it was fascinating. Yes, you all came. Ein ha'isha miskanes ela bi'era chaverta. It makes a woman feel very uncomfortable when there is somebody else involved who's taking the attention of her husband. Gamka asher nises aldas came. Even if when they got married, this was the understanding of their marriage. So for example, the Gemara says, let's say a couple gets married and they have an understanding, we're going to live in this community. And then the husband wakes up one day, he says, you know, I'd like to move to another community. And the woman says, excuse me, when we got married, we made up, we were going to live here, it's closer to my family, it's somewhere where I'm more comfortable, the schools here are good for us, you want to move to another location, it has to work for everybody, but it doesn't work for me. So the fight gets so intense that they decide they need to get divorced. So who's at fault for ruining the marriage in such a case? That's a discussion in the Gemara. If we got married under these set of circumstances and this was the understanding, then how can you blame me when I don't want to go along with the change in the plan? So that's the same over here. The question is, if this was the understanding, then what right does a woman have to say that I'm not interested in this kind of marriage anymore? And they wrote, look at one line down. Anima supak. Im niten liris asaisha kimoredes. Kasher ena chafetza b'chaim mishutafim. It's a very reasonable objection of a woman to be uncomfortable and to feel it is irritating, yachad am isha nosefes, to split her time with another woman in the marriage. V'gami milechatchila nisus aldas kein, even though it's true that when they first got married, this was the understanding, yecholah liton, she could say, shelo ha'aricha karoi es hakashim, she did not properly understand. She was not able to properly evaluate the agmas nefesh with such a life. She never would have imagined that this is what it is. Ubifrat la'achar she'akra le'eretz. So he says, Yaakov Avinu did it, and he was married to Rachel and Leah. The answer is, number one, he says, Rachel had a problem with it, and that was Rachel Imenu. It was not comfortable for Rachel and Leah. And on top of that, not everybody in the world is expected to be like Yaakov and Rachel and Leah. Most of us, he writes, are average people. And as a result of that, it's understandable that somebody would have an issue with this. I just thought that that was a fascinating discussion in halacha that came about as a result of a discussion in this week's parsha. But anyway, not the focus of our shir, just something interesting to think about. When analyzing these psukim, the first question that strikes us is, how is it possible that Rachel, the Torah says, that Rachel has tremendous sense of jealousy, that she is uncomfortable with her sister to the point that she's envious of her and resentful of Leah? As the Torah says, Vatikane Rachel ba'achosa. We know that jealousy is something that is so miserable of a character trait. We know that it makes people miserable. We know that it's vile, it's repulsive. So much so that the Navi Yeshaya writes that Liyasid Lavo, our dream of Liyasid Lavo is we're going to live in a perfect world. What that means exactly, I don't know. But the Nevi'im give us little snippets, little insights to appreciate exactly what it means. The Navi Yeshaya writes, one of the things that's going to immediately change when we have this existence of Liyasid Lavo is going to be Visara Kines Ephraim, Vitzorere Yehuda Yikaresu. Ephraim lo Yikane es Yehuda, Yehuda lo Yatzer es Ephraim. Different families will not be jealous of each other. So when I look on Facebook and I see that somebody else has a life that just looks perfect, I don't know if anybody else sees this. You know, I get my kids up in the morning and they don't always get dressed exactly when they're supposed to. They don't always make the bus. Yonina, you know, sometimes we're late for the bus. You know, they don't always make the bus. Sometimes we need to drive them. They don't always eat their dinner when they're supposed to. And the house is not always as clean as it should be. And there's stuff all over the place when they come home from school, right? Somehow I look on Facebook, which I don't have. But somehow I look on Facebook and I see other people's pictures of their homes. And it's just always perfect and always beautiful. And dinner is always a five-course meal. How can that be? Do they not work? Does nobody in the world work? Does everybody in the world have perfect children? And my house is just upside down just because I have five boys? Is that what it is? It's hard for me to imagine, but that is the kind of culture. We know that it's sheker. We know that there's nothing true about it. We know that it's false. We know that people are posting pictures that are not the reality of their lives. And sometimes it makes people feel jealous. Somebody else says this. Well, you don't realize the thousand other things that are going wrong in their lives. I think about it so often. I see on people's WhatsApp statuses here in the shul. You know, people post things on WhatsApp all the time. I always look at them because I learn a lot about people from that. And I find it very interesting. You were just in my house last night talking about something very, very problematic. And now all of a sudden on your WhatsApp status, you're professing to the world that everything's perfect. Everything is amazing. And look what happened. Look, I served my kids pancakes and syrup this morning. And it was just a hunky-dory day and everything's wonderful and my life is perfect. Why are you putting that out to the world? First of all, why is it important for the world to know what your kids had for breakfast or what you're serving for dinner? It's ridiculous. But outside of that, how do you portray something that you know is going to make people envious of you when they shouldn't be envious? There's nothing to be envious about your life. Nothing. Zero. Your life is upside down. Be honest. Or don't say anything. It actually reminds me. Somebody once went to Rav Chaim Kanievsky and he said, you know, I'm a little bit nervous of an ayin hara. I'm nervous people are going to be jealous of me. He said, why? He said, I just won the lottery. You know, mifal apayis in Israel. So somebody wins the lottery. So this man says to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, I'm nervous that people are going to be jealous of me. He says, why? He said, I just won the lottery. How much did you win? A few million dollars. So he asks him, did you ever finish all of Shas? He says, no. Did you ever finish a Masechta? He says, yes. He says, do you know it by heart? He says, no. Do you know any Parsha and Chumash by heart, beginning to end? No. Who in the world would be jealous of you? Who cares? So you won a few million dollars? You have nothing to be concerned about. So you want a few million dollars? Who's jealous of somebody who doesn't even know a Parsha and Chumash by heart? What are you? What's the value? So what? You have money? So anyway, the Navi Yeshaya writes that kina is something that is so destructive. It's so corrosive. Being jealous of other people is such a miserable trait that liyasid lavo, that is one of the first things that is going to be removed from our personality. We're not going to have that experience of feeling jealous of other people. I'll be happy that you're successful, that I'm successful, that you're doing your thing, that my kids are doing their thing, that everyone's doing what they're supposed to do. We'll make everybody feel comfortable, and we're not going to feel the sense of enviousness anymore. So if that's the case, the question then becomes, how is it that Rachel was jealous, was envious of her sister? How could it be? We're talking about Rachel Imenu, a great tzaddikus, a neviah. How is that possible? And this is the question that is asked by the Medrash. Look at the bottom of number Gimel, where the Medrash says, Amar Rav Yitzchak. Ksiv, it says, Al yikane libcha bechatayin ki im biyiras Hashem kol hayom. Don't allow yourself to get caught up with kina, with jealousy. Ve'ata omer, and you're telling me, vatikane rachel ba'achosa, can that be understood at face value? Is it possible? Ela melamed, the answer, says the Medrash, is not that she was jealous of her, but rather shekin asa b'maaseha hatovim. Rachel Imenu looked at her sister Leah and she said, look, we grew up in the same house. We're very similar. Why is it that she has children and I don't? Rachel came to her own conclusion. Don't make a mistake and dare ever draw this conclusion on another person. But Rachel came to her own conclusion and said, Ilule shehi tzadekes lo haisa yoledes. Obviously, she's far more worthy than I am. Obviously, she is far more of a tzadekes, far more virtuous than I ever will be, because how could it be? We both got married at the same time, and yet she has children and I don't. It must be that she is greater than I. And I'm jealous not of her lot in life, I'm jealous of the fact that she is a greater person than I am. That's what the Torah says here. That's what the Medrash tells us. Now again, let's just repeat. To cast an aspersion on somebody else and say, oh, from the fact that they don't have children, it must be that they are unworthy of children, is unacceptable. But here the Medrash says that Rachel makes a cheshbon ha-nefesh and says, it must be that Leah is more worthy than I am. The Rishonim ask, how do you ever know when somebody has pure and genuine jealousy, pure and genuine kina, like Rachel Imenu here, that was jealous of the right thing? And when is it jealousy like most of us have for other people? So the Rishonim say that there was a story of Mashal, of a melech, who calls in two people, and one of them happens to be extremely jealous of another person. He's always mekana, he's always envious of everything he sees in other people's lives. And the other one just loves money. He loves lots of things. He loves to have things. So the king calls both of them in and he says, look, I have unlimited resource. I can do anything. I just want to play a little trick with two of you. Whoever makes the first request, whatever request you make, you're going to get, but your friend is going to get double. And both of them are looking at each other. Oh, who should go first? Well, you know, I love money, so I want double. And he says, well, I'm jealous, so if you go first, then I go first. Nobody's sure what to do. Finally, the one who has so much kina turns to the melech and he says, okay, I'd like you to cut off my right hand. And his friend was going to get double. So the Rishonim say that's the way to understand the difference between kina when it's coming from a pure and genuine place and when it's coming from a rotten and evil place in our hearts. When we just want something because we want to better enhance our lives, that's fine, that's pure. Like Rachel Imenu says, I would be more whole, I would be more complete if only my life looked a little bit different. But the Rishonim say, when I want, not because I want, but because I also don't want you to have, I want you to lose out also, that's when we know that it's coming from a bad place. That's when we know that it's inappropriate and it's misguided. So how could it be? So the Torah tells us here that Rachel Imenu was of the belief that obviously my sister Leah must be greater than I am. And her intentions were pure. But Tekane Rachel Ba'achosa, she was jealous of her sister. She was envious not of what her sister had and what she was lacking, but rather of the fact that her sister must have been a greater person than she was. You go a little bit further in the Pasuk and it says that she opens up to her husband again a very emotional few words and she says, if you don't help me, im ayin, mesa anochi. I can consider myself dead. Now what kind of way of speaking is that? And if you look here, the Gemara says in Maseches Avodah Zarah, turn over the page, Amar Rabbi Shua ben Levi, number Dalet. Kal adam she'en lo banim, a very extreme statement where the Gemara tells us, somebody who is not blessed with children is chashuv kemes, in some ways considered as if they are not alive. Now, what does that mean, says the Gemara? Shenemar, because we learn from Rachel Imenu, where she pleads with her husband and she says, Havali banim v'imayin mesa anochi. The Medrash picks up on that comment and says, Amu Rabu Seinu, mikana talamed, from here you learn, shekal mi she'en lo banim chashuv kemes. As we see from Chana, we're all familiar with the story of Chana, she also had a co-wife, very similar dynamic to what happened here. Chana and Penina were both married to Elkanah, who was the Gadol Ador at the time. Like Rachel and Leah, were married to Yaakov Avinu. Penina is growing a family, everything's healthy, everything's fine, and Hannah cannot figure out why she's unable to have children. And Hannah says, ultimately, when she did have a child, she's blessed with a child by the name of Shmuel, the Tfilas Hannah. So she says, Hashem Memis Umechayeh. She thanks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and she says, you are the one who gives life, you are the one who takes away. Elakach Amar Hannah, what does she mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Memis Umechayeh? Ad Shelo Nasan Li Ben Hayisa Min Amesin. Before I had a child, I considered myself not to be alive. Achshav Shenasan Li Ben, now that HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed me with a child, Nimnesi Im Achayim. Now I consider myself to be alive. It happens to be the response, the reaction of Elkanah is also very strange, hard to understand. Hannah, the same way Rachel did, Hannah's pleading with her husband and she says, figure this out, give me children, figure out how to help me. And what does he respond? He says, Halo Anochi Tov Lach Me'asara Banim. Come on, you have me. What do you need children for? It's got to be like the most insensitive response. It's hard to understand this. How can it be? Elkanah, you're smarter than that. Elkanah turns back to his wife and says, it's okay. You don't need children. I have a loving husband. What's the issue? So again, a lot of interpretation is necessary here. Similar to Yaakov Avinu. His wife comes to him and starts crying hysterically, and he says, you think I'm God? You think I can change this? That seems extremely insensitive, which we're going to get to in a few minutes. Again, needs a very important interpretation. But the Gemara here says that somebody who doesn't have children is chashuv kemes. It's hard to explain exactly why that should be. Why is somebody who doesn't have children considered in some way to be comparable to the experience of death? So on a simple level, some explain the reason why is because everybody lives through life knowing that we're all human beings. We all have the experience of mortality. We know we're not going to be here forever. But most of the time, we don't think about it because we don't have to. Why? Because our way of connecting to eternity, our way of reminding ourselves that we are perpetually going to be relevant in this world is the fact that we brought children into the world, that we have those who are going to continue on and transmit our legacy and the stories about us to the next generation. So I don't feel so terrified when I face my own mortality because I know that there are people who are going to come after me who are going to stand in the place of everything that I represented. Somebody who doesn't have children, some explain, are constantly confronted with their own mortality. Every time they think about it, it's, I'm the end of the line. And what will ever be with me after I'm no longer here? I'm only human. So is there anything that's going to live on after me? Is there any way to perpetuate all that I've tried to accomplish in my life? And that perhaps is why the Medrash and the Gemara tell us that somebody who doesn't have children is in some way considered comparable to a person who experiences death. But perhaps there's something deeper here. Because the truth is, if you look in the Gemara says that this is not in a category of its own. The Gemara says that there are arba chashuvim kemes. There are four different people, four different experiences, that one who undergoes them is considered to be in some way like the experience of death. And what are those four? Anybody know? What? A blind person. The Gemara says a suma, somebody who's blind. The second example is an ani, somebody who's destitute, somebody who's poor. The third that the Gemara says is a mitzora, somebody who has tzaras. And the fourth is one who doesn't have children. Now, how do we know that? How do we know that a mitzora is chashuv kemes? So the Gemara says we learn it from Miriam Hanaviyah. The story of Miriam was that she speaks Lashon Hara about her brother, Moshe Rabbeinu, and she doesn't like the shidduch. Moshe Rabbeinu marries an Isha Kushis. What that means, I don't exactly know. It seems to mean that he married a woman who was a different pigmentation, a different color. The Mefarshim explain it means something else. But either way, he married somebody that his siblings were not happy with, and they got in a whole discussion about it, and they were talking down about Moshe Rabbeinu, and they were adverse to the shidduch. And as a result of that, she was immediately struck with tzaras, and she goes to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, look what happened, I did a terrible thing, and now I was afflicted with tzaras. And Moshe Rabbeinu offers a tefillah, and he says, Al na tehi kemes, I hope my sister is not going to die. So the Gemara says, from the fact that he refers to his sister who has tzaras as somebody who is close to death, means that that experience is chashuv kemes. Now, how do you explain that? There are hundreds of complicated syndromes that people can have, many, many terrible diseases and illnesses and ailments people can suffer with. So why is it that somebody who has taras is considered to be like a mace? Is that so much more severe? Is that more intense? Is the scope of taras something that is so much more overwhelming? Talk to somebody who's undergoing chemo in the hospital and undergoing active treatment. They'll tell you that that is chashuv kemeis. What is taras more severe and more intense than anything else that any of us have seen or experienced with ourselves or our friends or in our community? We've seen worse. So what is it about taras? And is this just an arbitrary list? Is this just four different people who happen to find themselves in the same category? Or is there something that unites all of them to teach us a lesson that the Gemara is trying to get across? So there's a beautiful interpretation by Reb Chaim Shmulevitz in his Sefer Sichas Musar. I find it's just such a penetrating observation. It's just so, gives such a deep level of understanding to this Gemara. And he says that the unique characteristic of a human being, the most unique component of our lives as human beings, is that we have the ability to provide for others, that we have the ability to be supportive and to give aid and service to other people. The children of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, Chaim Volozhiner was the preeminent Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. The children of Rav Chaim Volozhiner write in the introduction to the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, "V'ko haya dibro dvaro elai tamid." And our father, the great Rav Chaim Volozhiner, used to tell us all the time, "Shezeh kol ha'adam." This is the essence, this is the foundation, this is the heart of what a person is. Lo li'atzmo nivra, I'm not here for myself. Rak lehoel la'acherim kechal asher yimatzeh b'kocho lasos. I find that a fascinating statement. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, I would imagine, spent most of his day learning and teaching Torah. And when his children, I so often think at a levaya, when children speak about their parents, and you listen carefully to what they choose to highlight about their parents' lives, it's just something that says so much about who the person was. Not always is it who we thought they were. I'll give you an example. I was actually in touch last week with Gila Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs' daughter. And we exchanged emails, we were talking, and I pointed out how I find it extremely inspiring that her father, who was known to the world as a major philosopher, as a major spokesman, as a lot of things, a major intellectual, has such a simple matseva that was crafted by his family. You know what it says on there? Tzama lecha nafshi. Tzama lecha nafshi. His family felt that that's what encapsulated his life. Tzama lecha nafshi. How is it that speaking in the halls of government in every country is part of Tzama lecha nafshi? It's that he had an insatiable desire to come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he felt that by being Mekadesh Shem Shamayim on the grand scale that he did was all part of that one mission. But would any of us ever encapsulated his life in that phrase? I never would have said that. I would have written, he was an author of 35 best-selling books. I would have written many other things about him, and yet all it says is that. It says so much about who a person is, about what their essence is about. So the children of Rav Chaim Volozhiner write, "Our father used to talk to us all the time. Ask anyone in my family, what did my father tell us all the time?" It's probably not what you thought, but children know their parents very, very well. They have a certain insight that outsiders do not have. And yet, the children of Rav Chaim Volozhiner said, you know what our father's common refrain to us always was? What he always told us was that the essence of man, the essence of a human being, the heart and soul of what we are all about is lo li'atzmo hunivra. I'm not here for myself. I'm here to be meitiv la'acherim kechal asher yimatzeh b'kocho lasos. To go to the extreme, to be there for other people. That's why I'm here. That's what our father used to tell us all the time. And writes Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, when the Gemara says arba chashuvim kemeis, that four different experiences are considered comparable to death. What does that mean? And is this just an arbitrary list? At random, we chose four different things in the experience of man to put in this list? No. This was very deliberate. This is very intentional because he says there is one common factor that is shared by all of these, and that is a person who is not alive. We know that somebody who works on the Chevra Kadisha is referred to as doing a chesed shel emes. What does it mean, a chesed shel emes? That you can't get repaid for that because the person is no longer alive. They can't give back for what you've done to them. So you're doing it completely altruistically. You're doing it without any intention of ever getting anything in return. Everything else in life works on reciprocity. I do something for you. Again, I don't think this way, but it's understood. I do something for you. At some point, you're also going to do something for me. That's the way it goes. That's the way friendships normally work. A chesed shel emes means I do a favor for somebody who has an inability to give back to me in any way. That is what it means to be no longer alive. The lack of the ultimate ability of a human being to give. That's what it means to be dead, that you cannot give anymore. You cannot provide, you cannot help, you cannot support, you can't assist somebody else who needs something. And he explains as follows. Moshe Rabbeinu, it says, Vayar b'sivlosam. He goes outside from the palace of Paro, and he opens his eyes and he sees what's going on. Writes from Chaim Shmulevitz, a person who is a Suma, of course, they can do so many wonderful things with their life, and we've seen so many people who are blind who really accomplish tremendous things against all odds. But he says there's something so fundamental that they are robbed of. They don't have the full opportunity of experiencing somebody else's pain. They don't have the full opportunity to experience, to see. Sometimes I look at someone, I see there's something wrong. I know that I should be giving to them. I know I should be providing. That Suma doesn't have that ability. They don't have that insight because they can't see. They're not able to experience somebody else's need the way many other people are able to. And that's why the Gemara says, in a certain sense, he's chashuv kemes. It doesn't mean his life is meaningless, chas v'shalom. But it means that in a certain sense, he's robbed of the opportunity to be there to provide for other people. Somebody who's chashuv kemes. You know, having a child is the greatest, most extreme experience of giving. Parents give indiscriminately to their children. Whether the children turns around and spits in the parents' face, the parents will continue to give. And when the parents feel that the kids are not appreciating at all anything they do for them, they're still going to show unrestrained love. They're still going to give them without any gvul, without any boundary. This is just uninhibited love. That's the way parents treat their children. Somebody who's not given the opportunity to raise a child is taking away. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't give that person the opportunity to feel what it means to be the ultimate giver. That's what it means to be a giver, is to be a parent. And that's why the Gemara says that somebody who doesn't have children, call him a gadol yasam b'self beso. If you adopt somebody, it doesn't mean biological child. Hamagadol yasam b'self beso means you have a child who needs a home, and you bring that child into your home, and you take care of them, is ki'ilu yolado. It's as if I gave birth to them. What do you mean it's as if I gave birth? Obviously, it's not the same. But in this aspect, because I can show that unbridled love, I can just keep on giving to a person who I adopt as a child. Doesn't matter if it's my biological child or not. But it's the experience that a person who never is blessed with children is never going to be able to have, is never going to be able to fully appreciate what it means to give unconditionally every day, every single night, to give so much of themselves. An ani, obviously the life of an ani is meaningful, and obviously there's so much they can accomplish, but in the most basic of senses, they're so busy worrying about their own needs, trying to put food on the table, they're not able to provide for other people, they're not able to be there for others. And finally he says about a mitzora, about somebody who has taraz, the Torah describes the experience of taraz, badad yeshev michutz l'machaneh. That mitzora has to be isolated. That mitzora has to be detached. We remove that person from the community. As a result of that, we take away your ability to do anything with anybody else. Here, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, is what it means, arba chashuvin kemes. It's not just because somebody who doesn't have children is considered to be facing their mortality all the time because they don't have a progeny, they don't have a future. It's not what it is. It's so much deeper than that. It's that they don't have the ability to experience the essence of what man is about. They don't have the ability to experience what it means to be the ultimate giver. That's what a parent does. That's the nature of what it means to be a parent. And that's what it means when it says, Arba chashuvin kemes. That is what Rachel Imenu says. I don't want this for myself. Imayin Mesa Anochi, why am I alive? The point of life is to be able to give, and God is not giving me the opportunity to give. I want to be a giver. I want to be that person who's just constantly giving and showering my child with love, but I can't. I don't want this because I selfishly feel that this is what I want. Rachel Imenu just encourages people to think about the experience and the blessing of what it means to be a parent. And that's what she means here. Im ayin mesa anochi. Now let's move on to the next part of the narrative, and that is also, as we mentioned, very, very troubling. Yaakov Avinu hears his wife breaking down, crying to him. Vayichar af Yaakov berachel. Yaakov Avinu gets angry, he's irritated, he's resentful toward his wife. Chachmei Hadar Meshem Rab Alexandri said, HaChacham Yana Das Ruach. A wise person knows how to respond appropriately. Ze Avram. That is Avram Avinu. What happens when Sarah Imenu comes to talk to Avram Avinu and she's beside herself, she doesn't have children, what's going to be? What does it say? Vayishma Avram Lekol Sarah. Avram Avinu listens. He's fully concentrated on what she's saying. He's focused. You don't always need to respond. Avram Avinu taught us the way a Chacham responds is sometimes when you have nothing to say, don't say it. You come to a Shiva house and you have nothing good to say, don't say it. Just listen. Which is actually the halacha. It says that the protocol in a Shiva home is you have to wait for the Avel to start the conversation. Because the conversation is not about my interests. It's not about my curiosity. How many medications were they on? And was there a malpractice? And which hospital were they in? And we're never going to use this again. And the doctor's terrible. It's not what's relevant. The reason why I'm at a Shiva house is to help that person who's struggling. The way to help them is to listen. Not to insert myself. Not to talk. Not to always think that I need to have a funny or cute line in response to whatever it is that they're saying. But to listen. And if I have nothing to respond, don't respond. Just listen. That was powerful, that was meaningful to Sarah Imenu when her husband simply listened. Contrasted to Yaakov Avinu here, where the Medrash picks up on this pasuk and says, Vayichar af Yaakov berachel. The Medrash condemns Yaakov Avinu. The Medrash finds fault in Yaakov Avinu's response. Can you be so callous, so indifferent, so insensitive and unemotional? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kach onim es hama'ikos. Is that the way that you treat somebody who's suffering? Is that the way? You have a woman who's clearly tormented because she doesn't have children. Yaakov, you're doing fine. You have a bunch of kids. You're okay. Your wife, Rachel Imenu, comes to you and she's so pained by her situation. And she's in such a delicate, fragile place. You get angry at her? That's what you do? Chayecha. The Medrash says, God said to Yaakov Avinu then, Shebanecha asidim lamo defnei bina. Something is going to happen down the line where your children, Yaakov, are going to have to need something from her child. That was a forecast to the story of Yosef and the brothers, where they were very much in need, but that in some way, the Medrash says, was an onesh, was a punishment for this kind of callous and insensitive reaction of Yaakov Avinu. The Medrash then goes further, if you look in the next, on the Medrash Tanchuma. Ruach HaKodesh Omeres, HaChacham Yana Das Ruach. Is that the way that a wise person responds? Amar Yaakov L'Rachel. Yaakov responds to his wife, V'chi Antidistar Shel HaKodesh Baruch Hu Ani. Do you think that I am the equivalent of God? Do you think that I am the agent? Do you think that I am the replacement of HaKodesh Baruch Hu? HaSachas Elokim Anochi. You're crying to me. You think I can change it? I have nothing to do. Amar Le HaKodesh Baruch Hu Chayecha. You said to your wife these words, Hasachas Elokim Anochi, do you think I'm in the place of God? Her son, down the line, is going to say that to your children, Hasachas Elokim Ani, when the brothers are pleading for their lives and asking Yosef, don't pay us back for the terrible things we did to you, now that Yaakov Avinu died, now we know that you're just going to unleash and unhinge yourself and destroy the Jewish people as a result of everything we put you through. And Yosef turns back and he says, Hasachas Elokim Ani? Writes the Medrash, that was a direct reaction to these words that Yaakov Avinu said to his own wife, Rachel. So what did she want him to do? Amar lo, Kacha Yitzchak Avicha Osa L'Rivka Imecha? Rachel responds and says, when your parents didn't have children, and your mother Rivka went crying to your father, you think that was the response? Is this appropriate? Lo hayushneim omdim u'mispalalim zeh keneged zeh? Don't you think that they sat there and they davened? Do you think that Yitzchak didn't care that Rivka was in so much agony and pain? Afata tispalal alai el Hashem. What I expect of you, Yaakov, is not to make a miracle. I expect you to pray on my behalf. Daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give it all you have. And that is what Avraham Avinu did as well. And it's important. The takeaway, at least from this part of the Medrash, is two things. Not only to have an extra special degree of sensitivity and compassion and awareness of people who are struggling with infertility, but also to think about when they may cry to us and we throw up our hands and say, Hasafas Elokim Ani. We may not say it to their face, but sometimes we think, is there anything I can do? There's not really much that I can do. But you look back at the words of the Medrash, and the expectation is, at the very least, the bare minimum that you can do is offer a tefillah for them. Is ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have rachmanas on these people. It became a famous story because it was written up in the Mishpacha magazine. But it was a story in our family that we know is true because we were all there. I remember a number of years ago, my father was in Eretz Yisrael, and there was a taxi driver. My father left his attaché in the... He still calls it an attaché, so we'll call it that. He left it in the taxi, and he has his whole life in there. Literally everything. He doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have a cell phone. His whole life is in there. So he left it in a taxi. A couple of hours later, he gets a phone call. My brother got a phone call. Somebody had it. Anyway, the taxi came back. My father paid him for his time for coming back. It was actually on NCSY Cola. My brother asked him, is there anything that we can do for you? You know, we're very appreciative. He said, yes. You know, my wife and I have been married 14 years. We never had children. I heard, you know, I looked through your father's Rolodex here in his bag. I called a bunch of people to find out who this was, and they put it together. They told me, oh, it's Rav Schechter. This person wasn't religious. He said, I hear he's a big tzaddik. Maybe he can offer a tefillah that we should have a child. So they wrote down his name, gave it to my father. Anyway, about 2 years later, we were in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore by my brother for a yantif on Simchas Torah. And there was somebody who came over to me, and he said, you know, I just came back from Eretz Yisrael. I'm so uncomfortable. Like, I'm scared of your father. He said, no, he's the nicest guy. Go over to him. He said, no, I don't even know how to say this to him. I was taking a taxi. I just flagged down a taxi on my way to the airport. I don't know who the guy is. He asked me if I'm going to America. I said, yes. He said, oh, do you ever hear of Rav Schechter? He said, yes. So he said, I'm actually going to be with him over Yantif. We're going to be in Baltimore together. So he said, this taxi driver didn't tell me his name, didn't tell me anything. He said, tell Rav Schechter that the taxi driver had a baby. So the guy walks over to me, tells me the story. I said, I think you should tell my father. We know exactly what you're talking about. So tells my father. My father broke down crying. Anyway, we came back to the meal. And I said to my father, I said, Daddy, come on. You didn't really daven for the guy. You offered it, I don't know, like, it's a very nice story. They don't all end so beautifully. My father turned around to all of us, and he said, what are you talking about? 3 times a day, every day, from the day I met him. To me, that was more powerful than anything else. Whether he had the baby in the end or he didn't. You know, sometimes people talk to you about an issue. Do you take it enough to heart to ask, to offer a tefillah? Forget about 3 times a day, every day, for 2 years. But once in your life, to offer a tefillah on their behalf, to feel and to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should have rachmanas on this person. So the Mishpacha magazine changed the story a little bit. They wrote, Rav Schechter promised him in a year you'll have a child. That's not true. It just makes the story sound nicer. But the story is true. And what I was annoyed about the story was they missed out the most important part, that he said 3 times a day he's been davening for this person who he never knew, who he knows nothing about other than the fact that he just gave him back his bag. I think that's a very important takeaway from the story. So the question here that the Rishonim ask is, how could Yaakov Avinu be so insensitive? How is it possible? Yaakov Avinu was not a husband who was just out to lunch who didn't get it. He was very sensitive. So how did he not understand? And the Rishonim write, the Abarbanel explains in Amar Ches, he did it on purpose. It was in order to make his wife break down. He wanted her to evoke an extremely emotional response, because he said, imagine a tefillah that comes through such pain and such distress. If my wife thinks she has me, at least she feels supported. Imagine if I tell my wife, even I abandon you. You know what's going to be her next step? She's going to realize, the only one who's left with me is God Himself. Can you imagine what kind of tefillah that's going to be that she's going to offer? His intent, right, the Rishonim, was l'shem shamayim. He was trying to help her. And that's why he roughly turns away and says, Hasachas Elokim ani, you think I can do anything? You have to take care of your problem. This is your issue, it's not mine. He wasn't being insensitive. He was trying to evoke her reaction and her response, which would help her have the most powerful tefillah that she could possibly offer. Which is very similar to the story, as we mentioned, of Chana and Penina. As we know, the Psukim tell us in Sefer Shmuel that Chana and Penina are both married to Elkanah. Penina is blessed with children. Chana does not have children. And the Psukim tell us there that Penina was always trying to agitate her sister, her co-wife. She was always trying to make her feel uncomfortable. And she would go over to her and say, oh, you know, I just got the report cards. I had PTA tonight. You want to join me? I need a babysitter tonight. We have a wedding. You know, I know that you weren't invited. Can you come over to the house? I mean, every insensitive thing in the world, Penina was saying to Chana. To which the Gemara asks, can that be? Penina, you're so insensitive. You don't understand. A woman doesn't have children. This is the way you talk to her. And the Gemara says, Penina, l'shem shamayim niskavna. Penina realized, if I make Chana feel such a sense of despair, so dejected and so despondent, if I make her feel so alone that there's nobody helping her, no one to support her, she's going to realize that this is only left in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's nobody out there in the world. And imagine the tefillah she's going to offer. The Gemara says, Penina was the Shem Shamayim Niskavna. Penina had every positive intention in what she was doing, in agitating and irritating her sister-in-law, her co-wife. It was on purpose that she did that. And yet the Gemara says, Penina was punished. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz asks, I don't understand. How could it be? The Medrash says over here, Yaakov Avinu has in mind l'shem shamayim. He wants his wife to have children. He wants her tefillah to be answered. And the greatest way to evoke a response is, Shari Demos Lo Ninalu. If a person cries in their tefillah, Kadosh Baruch Hu won't turn that away. So if that's what you have in mind, Yaakov Avinu, that's what you have in mind, Penina. Why is Yaakov Avinu punished? Why is Penina punished for doing something that was bringing about a positive result? A couple of years ago, there was a story in Eretz Yisrael. There was a young man who was very arrogant, very cavalier. He was dating. And every girl that was suggested for him, he found some kind of fault in her. Everything. And he said, no, there's this shortcoming, that deficiency, this problem, this imperfection. Everything was wrong. And he was getting older and older. And, you know, he still believe that he has it right, he has it all figured out. And one of his mentors was very upset that his student was behaving this way. So he decided he's going to figure out how to fix him. So he comes over to him one day in the yeshiva and he says, you know, I have a great shidduch for you. I met a young woman. I was at a wedding last night. I really think she's perfect. The boy was like so over the moon, can't believe it. The Rosh Hashiva is setting him up. And he turns around and he says, so I'm going to tell you all about her. She's really lovely. She's wonderful. Everything's great. And she's just so, such a chayin and positive. It's just amazing. One problem, she only has one leg. She's crippled. It's fine. She uses a wheelchair, so you'll have to wheel her around. It's not a big deal, but like everything else about her is just wonderful. The boy looks at his Rebbe and he's like, you know, what is this? I'm sure she's lovely, but you think that's what I'm looking for? I don't understand. Like, let her marry someone who has a handicap. You think she's going to marry someone like me? And the boy is so dejected, he can't believe it. He's so flustered. He walks away. He's just so humiliated. A few days go by, the Rebbe comes back to him again. He says, you know, I was at another wedding. I met another lovely girl. She's amazing. I really think she's good for you. And the boy turns back to the Rebbe. He says, Nu, what now? What do you have in mind? He says, she happens to have been married twice before. It's a whole long story. She's 35 years older than you. Can't explain it, but something about her really made me feel that it was perfect for you. I think it's just, just, it really spoke to me. I think, every time I think about you, I really think about her, and I think it's just a perfect shidduch. The boy turns to his Rebbe, he's like, what's wrong with you? I don't understand. 35 years older than me, and she's divorced twice. I mean, this is not appropriate. This is not a perfect match for me at all. Okay, he walks away. A couple of weeks go by. The boy gets engaged to somebody else. And the Rebbe turns to him and he says, so how'd you find this girl? Miss Perfect that you were looking for, Miss America. So how did you find her? And the boy says, I'll tell you the truth. After you put me in my place and made me realize that maybe I'm not as perfect and amazing as I thought I was, because this is what you think of me, then it made me realize maybe I have to think differently. And then the Rebbe turned around and he asked himself, was I allowed to do that? Like, I made the guy feel awful. I made him feel horrible. But I did it all because I wanted him to get married someday, and I knew it would never happen unless I break him. So I broke him. I broke him because I needed to. Somebody needed to. That's the question that is asked over here. Yaakov Avinu breaks his wife Rachel for good reason, because he believes that that's the way that she's going to be blessed with a child. Penina breaks her co-wife Chana because she believes this is the best outcome for her co-wife Chana. So why were they punished? As Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, someone does something to Shem Shamayim, they get punished. How can that be? Explains Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, what you need to understand is that when we deal with Bein Adam L'Chaveru, with somebody's feelings, it's not about retribution, it's not about an onesh, it's not about do I deserve it, do I not. He says, it's like fire. Somebody sticks their hand into a fire. Doesn't matter if they did it on purpose or by mistake. It could have been the biggest accident. They're going to get burnt. It's the reality. You know, we're so nervous when children are near fire. What do you mean? We told you not to do it. When a kid touches a fire and burns their hand, you don't say, I told you not to do that. Doesn't help. Now they're burnt. You have to get them help. Whether they wanted to do it, they tried to do it, they had intention to do it, doesn't matter. The reality is they got burnt. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, people's feelings are like fire. You play with someone's feelings, as noble as your intentions might be, as wonderful as you think whatever it is that you're doing is, you need to understand that you're playing with fire. And that's why the Gemara says, Yom Kippur is in some way the catch-all. It's able to have a mechilas avonos, a kapara. There's so many different things that can be wiped out by Yom Kippur. Except for Averah Shebein Adam L'Chaveru. The Gemara says, Yom Kippur does not help. When I do something that negatively impacts another person, when I play with their emotions and when I play with their feelings, Yom Kippur is not mechaper. That's what the Gemara says. It's ad sheiratzeh es chaverah. I have to take it up with that person. And God is not interested in my Yom Kippur. Doesn't help. How so? Explains Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, because playing with somebody's emotions is playing with fire. And understand, as noble as the intention might be, Yaakov Avinu was a tzaddik. Penina was a tzaddikess. You think they wanted to cause harm? They wanted to cause hurt? They wanted to irritate them? Of course not. But yet, they were doing it and causing that sense of anguish, of despair, of despondency, and as a result, the Medrash says, they were punished, they were held accountable. Chaim Shmulevitz quotes an amazing story, the Gemara says in Ksuvos, that there was one of the Amoraim whose name was Rav Rechumi. We'll end in 2 minutes. So the Gemara says Rav Rechumi had this very unusual arrangement with his wife, that he would go away to study in some university all year, and he would come home on Yom Kippur. Every year he came home for Yom Kippur, and they spent a few days together, and then he went back for the year. I don't know, some kind of interesting marriage. But that's what the Gemara describes. So the Gemara says 1 year Erev Yom Kippur, for whatever reason, he was delayed. He was looking at his watch and he realized that by the time he's going to go home now, he's not going to be able to make it in time for Yom Kippur. So he may as well stay. What's he going to do? On the other end, the Gemara says that his wife was so anxious. She was so excitedly looking forward to seeing him for the first time in a year. And she's frantically running around the streets, looking, waiting on the highway to see, is her husband almost here? And she's so desperate to see him until finally she realizes it's already the Shkia. It's already sunset on the Leil Yom Kippur. Obviously, her husband's not going to travel on Yom Kippur. She begins to cry and she breaks down and she's so upset. How could it be that my husband, who I love so much, is not here? How did he miss it? The once a year when we get together, when we have an opportunity to spend time, he's not going to be home? And the Gemara says that he was back there. It wasn't his fault. He got stuck there. And it says that the floor collapsed beneath him and he died. as a punishment in response for the anguish that he caused his wife. Ask Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, if you would ask this woman, what do you prefer? You prefer your husband comes home next week a few days late? Or do you prefer to be an almana the rest of your life? What would you rather? Of course she's going to say, I love my husband. I don't want to be an almana. I don't want to be alone. I want him to be the father of my children. So what kind of punishment is that? You give a punishment to her that her husband should die? That's not what she wanted. Give him some other punishment to learn his lesson. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, you see from there, playing with Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is playing with fire. It's not that we make a calculation, oh, should we do this to you? Should we do that to you? We're going to figure out how to discipline this man for not being there for his wife. You made your wife cry. You made her break down crying. You made her lose it because you didn't show up and you were supposed to. I don't care how that happened or why it happened, but it's your fault. You're playing with fire. And understand that Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is fire. Anyway, a lot more to talk about. I see we're already over time. But I just thought that this was an opportunity for all of us to just give a few moments of our attention to be more sensitive, to be more careful, to be more understanding and attentive to those who are struggling with this tremendous nisayon. Amir Tz Hashem, we'll see everybody again next week. I wish everyone a wonderful day.